So picture this. The monitor is flashing red. Your patient is just gasping for air.
Oh, yeah. Eyes wide with absolute panic.
Right. And their oxygen saturations are just dropping by the second. And you are, a newly minted intern, and your mind just goes completely blank.
It's terrifying.
It really is. The pressure in that room is instantly suffocating. Honestly, it's one of the most terrifying clinical scenarios you can face at the bedside.
Oh, absolutely. It's kind of the ultimate test.
Yeah.
And, that instinct to just freeze up when someone is actively fighting for air right in front of you.
Yeah, that deer in the headlights feeling.
Exactly. That is a completely normal human response. But the difference between like a code blue and actually stabilizing the patient comes down to having a systematic mental framework to fall back on.
Right.
When the chaos peaks, fundamental physiology is what grounds you.
And that is exactly our mission for this deep dive. We're getting into part one of a two-part survival guide based on Dr. Jose A. Ribeiro's lectures on the emergency medicine approach to the dysmachic patient.
Yes, the crashing respiratory patient.
Exactly. So we're going to build that system for you today. First, we'll map out the four underlying physiological mechanisms of respiratory failure.
Because you really have to understand the mechanics first.
Right, before anything else. And then we'll arm you with the IMPACT-T mnemonic, which is this really rapid mental checklist to identify and treat the immediate life threats before the patient actually crashes.
Right, because before you can order a single intervention, a lab or an X-ray, you have to visualize the unseen mechanics. You have to know exactly how the respiratory system is failing that specific person in the bed.
Right, what's actually broken? So let's break down those four mechanisms. Ribeiro's framework starts with hypoventilation and decreased diffusion.
The first two.
Right. Now, hypoventilation is fairly intuitive, I think. The body just isn't moving enough air. PCO2 levels climb to these dangerous heights. And the causes are usually upstream of the lungs themselves.
Yeah, mostly neurologic or muscular.
Exactly. We're talking central nervous system injuries, opiate overdoses, or like profound neuromuscular weakness. The drive or the power to operate the lungs is just gone.
And importantly, the architecture of the lung in cure hypoventilation is perfectly intact. The lung
Yeah.
itself is fine.
Right. So I visualize this like a fireplace where the bellows are broken.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah. So the person operating the bellows, like the brain, in the case of a heroin overdose, they just stop pumping.
Right, exactly.
But then decreased diffusion is a totally different structural problem. The air actually reaches the alveoli, but the movement of O2 and CO2 across the alveolar membrane is impaired.
It's a barrier issue.
Yes. The classic culprits here are CHF, congestive heart failure, and severe pneumonia. So if hypoventilation is a broken bellows, decreased diffusion is like trying to breathe through a wet
A
sponge.
wet sponge? Yeah, that's a highly accurate way to visualize it.
Because the mechanical action is there, right? But the surface area is completely compromised.
Exactly. The membrane is thickened by interstitial fluid or, inflammatory exudate from an infection. And oxygen diffuses much slower through liquid than it does through a thin layer of healthy tissue.
Which makes sense.
Right. And this structural difference entirely dictates your bedside intervention. Like if you have the opiate overdose, your broken bellows giving supplemental oxygen works beautifully.
Because you're just enriching whatever little air that you're pulling in.
Precisely. You enrich those small tidal volumes. But throwing a standard nasal cannula on a patient drowning in pulmonary
And
edema.
it isn't going to fix the underlying defect.
No,
No.
because the oxygen can't penetrate that wet sponge efficiently just on its own. You need literal mechanical pressure.
Ah, so this is where BiPAP comes in.
Exactly. And that's why we rely so heavily on BiPAP for these patients. Bilevel positive airway pressure physically stents the airways open.
It forces it.
Right? It creates a pressure gradient that literally opposes the hydrostatic pressure of the pulmonary edema. You are forcefully driving the oxygen across that fluid-filled barrier and pushing the fluid back into the vasculature.
Wow, okay. So you're treating a hydrostatic problem with an aerodynamic solution. That makes perfect sense.
It really does when you break it down like that.
Okay, so we have the broken bellows and the wet sponge. Let's move to the second pair of mechanisms, which transitions us from the mechanics of moving air to the really delicate relationship between ventilation and perfusion.
Right, the V and the Q.
Exactly. We're talking about VQ mismatch and shunting.
And these are where things get mathematically and physiologically a bit more complex.
Yeah, they do.
In a healthy lung, ventilation the V and perfusion the Q are perfectly matched. Blood finds the air. But in a VQ mismatch, you have a roadblock on one side of that equation.
Right, and the classic roadblock being a pulmonary embolism, a PE. Where the airway is totally clear, The alveoli are full of fresh oxygen, but a massive clot in the pulmonary artery means the blood never actually reaches that segment of the lung.
Right, so that is entirely wasted ventilation.
Wasted ventilation, okay. Or, on the flip side of that, you have severe asthma, where the blood flow is perfectly fine, but the airway is clamped down so tight the air can't reach the capillary bed.
Which is wasted perfusion. And in both scenarios, the end result is profound hypoxia.
Right.
And in both scenarios, applying positive end expiratory pressure, or PEEP, alongside oxygen can be incredibly beneficial.
Because it forces things open.
Exactly. PEEP helps recruit collapsed alveoli and keeps those narrowed airways stented open during exhalation. It maximizes whatever functional surface area is left for gas exchange.
Okay, that makes sense for VQ mismatch. But then we hit shunting.
Ah, shunting.
Yeah, this one is tricky. It's defined as blood moving from the right side of the heart to the left side, entirely bypassing the alveolar gas exchange.
Right, a true bypass.
We see this in congenital heart defects with right-to-left shunts or, you know, massive lobar pneumonias where a whole segment of the lung is so consolidated that blood just passes through without picking up any oxygen at all.
Exactly.
But I'm genuinely hung up on this part. If you are standing next to a crashing patient with a right-to-left shunt and their O2 sats are at 70%, my brain automatically says, crank the wall oxygen to 15 liters.
Which is the natural reflex.
Right. But the text says that doesn't work. Why doesn't that brute force their saturations up? Like, where is the oxygen going?
Okay, so think about the hemodynamics of mixing. Let's say you have a patient with a severe right-to-left anatomical shunt. Maybe 30% of their deoxygenated systemic venous return is bypassing the lungs entirely through, say, a septal defect.
Just going straight through the heart.
Right, straight through, dumping straight back into the left atrium without ever seeing a lung.
Okay, so 70% is still going to the lungs, though.
Right, and if you put them on 100% oxygen, that 70% of the blood gets fully saturated, it's maxed out.
Yeah.
But here's the physical limitation. Hemoglobin can only bind so much oxygen. It gets 100% full, and that's it. It cannot carry enough extra dissolved oxygen to compensate for the 30% of completely unoxygenated blue blood that is mixing back into the left atrium.
Oh, wow.
The math simply doesn't allow it.
So no matter how much you hyperoxygenate the functional part of the lung, the admixture of that shunted deoxygenated blood just drags the overall systemic arterial saturation down.
Exactly. It's an anatomical detour.
Yes.
Throwing pure oxygen at it alone won't move the needle on their hypoxia because the blood causing the problem isn't even encountering the oxygen you're providing.
It's literally never seeing it.
Right. You have to address the underlying physiological or anatomical defect itself.
Wow, that distinction is crucial. Okay, so we've mapped the four foundational failures. We've got hypoventilation, decreased diffusion, VQ mismatch, and shunting.
The big four.
But when you are standing in that room and the alarms are blaring, you can't just ponder physiology. You need to rapidly cycle through the specific lethal diagnoses.
You need action.
Right. And this is where the impact stim mnemonic comes in for life-threatening dyspnea.
It's the ultimate mental checklist. I-M-P-A-C-T. You literally spell it out in your head to ensure you aren't missing a hidden assassin while you're maybe focused on more obvious symptoms.
So let's start with I, impacted foreign body, and MI.
Right.
And it's wild to think that 75% of the time you see an impacted airway, it's a kid under 9 who swallowed a coin or a piece of food.
Kids put everything in their mouths.
You really do. And anatomically, the right lower lobe is the most dependent portion of the lung. Because the right mainstem bronchus is wider, shorter, and more vertical than the left side.
It's practically a straight shot down.
Exactly. Gravity just pulls that object straight down into the right side.
Which is why, if you are examining a toddler with a sudden onset of unilateral wheezing on the right side.
Just the right side.
Right, just the right. A foreign body should be at the absolute top of your differential.
Good to know. Okay, moving to PEET pneumonia, PE, and pneumothorax. I want to spend a minute on pulmonary embolisms because I feel like this is where a lot of diagnostic anxiety lives for new doctors.
Oh, without a doubt. PE is the great masquerader.
Right. We all know the classic presentation, you know, unexplained tachycardia and dyspnea. We know Virchow's triad venous injury, hypercoagulability, and stasis.
Classic textbook stuff.
Exactly. But clinically, we are taught to look for these highly specific EKG findings, like an S1Q3T3 pattern or a new right bundle branch block.
Right.
But why does a blood clot in the lung actually alter the electrical axis of the heart?
Ah, so it comes down to acute mechanical strain. When a massive clot lodges in the pulmonary artery, the right ventricle suddenly finds itself pumping against a brick wall.
Because it's blocked.
Yes. The pressure on the right side of the heart skyrockets instantly.
So it's an acute right ventricular overload.
Exactly. That sudden dilation and strain on the right ventricle physically shifts the heart in the chest cavity.
Wait, it physically moves?
It stretches and shifts, yeah. And that alters the conduction pathways, which is exactly what generates that new right bundle branch block, or the classic S1Q3T3 on the EKG.
Wow.
You're seeing the electrical evidence of a mechanical traffic jam.
That is fascinating. And on the radiological side, you know, you might see Hampton's hump or the Westermark sign. But Dr. Rubero's framework explicitly warns that in a critically ill patient, the diagnosis is made by clinical suspicion, not a chest x-ray.
And that is a fundamental tenet of emergency medicine. You treat the patient, not the machine.
Right.
Let's look at the other T-stanchion pneumothorax. You might learn about the deep sulcus sign on an x-ray. But if your patient is fighting for air with a deviated trachea, distended neck veins, and their blood pressure is plummeting,
you do not wait for the portable x-ray machine.
You absolutely do not. If you wait for radiology, that patient will code.
Because they're basically suffocating inside their chest.
Exactly. Think about the pathophysiology. A tension pneumo creates a one-way valve in the pleural space. Air enters with every inspiration, but it cannot escape.
It just builds up.
Right. The intrapleural pressure rapidly builds, compressing the collapsed lung, and then it literally begins to shift the entire mediastinum toward the contralateral side.
Pushing the heart and the great vessels over.
Pushing them all over and physically kinking the superior and inferior vena cava.
Oh. So the venous return to the right atrium gets completely choked off.
Preload drops to zero. And if there's no blood entering the heart, there is no cardiac output.
So the heart is pumping empty.
Exactly. Blood pressure bottoms out.
Yeah.
And the patient dies of obstructive shock. You don't need a picture to confirm that. You need a 14-gauge needle in the second intercostal space immediately.
To vent that trapped air.
Yes, to unkink the plumbing. You act on clinical gestalt.
That mechanism is so elegant but so terrifying. The pressure literally suffocates the heart's ability to fill.
It's rapid and it's lethal.
And actually, that mechanical compression of the heart is the perfect bridge to understanding how we manage the next letters in the mnemonic, A and C.
Right.
Asthma, anaphylaxis, CHF, and COPD.
The chronic airway diseases that can suddenly spiral into acute, lethal crises.
Exactly. Now, the distinction between the emphysematous pink puffers and the bronchitic blue bloaters is, you know, classic board material. But the bedside reality of an acute exacerbation is really what we need to focus on.
The actual management.
Specifically, ventilator management. The framework dictates that for a crashing asthmatic or COPD patient, you must use low respiratory rates, low tidal volumes, and a low I to E ratio.
Low and slow.
Low and slow.
Yeah.
You intentionally utilize permissive hypercapnia, which basically means letting their PCO2 run high. But if you have a patient whose airway is spasming and they are severely acidotic, why in the world wouldn't you want to set the vent to clear that CO2 as fast as possible?
Seems counterintuitive, right?
Totally.
But trying to fix their blood gas with a fast respiratory rate will literally kill them.
Really?
Yes. You have to remember the core pathology of obstructive disease. The problem isn't getting air in. The problem is getting air out.
Right, because the airways are obstructed.
Exactly. The small airways are inflamed, they're filled with mucus, and severely narrowed.
So exhalation takes significantly longer.
Much, much longer. If you set the ventilator to a normal or, you know, a high rate, the machine forces a breath in, but before the patient can fully exhale that volume through those tiny straw-like airways.
The machine forces the next breath in.
Yes. And we call that breath stacking.
Breath stacking.
Or auto-PEEP. Volume builds upon volume. The lungs become progressively hyperinflated with every cycle.
Just blowing up like a balloon?
Exactly like a balloon.
Yeah.
And just like the tension pneumothorax we just discussed, those massive overinflated lungs press against the mediastinum. They compress the vena cava, preload drops, cardiac output tanks, and the patient becomes profoundly hypotensive.
Wow.
Or even worse, the sheer barotrauma pops a bleb on the lung and creates an actual pneumothorax.
So that low and slow vent strategy is literally a structural necessity.
It is.
You give them a small breath, and then you give them an incredibly long expiratory time so they can actually empty their lungs.
Let them breathe it out.
And you just tolerate the acidosis and the high CO2 because the alternative is popping their lungs or crushing their venous return.
Permissive hypercapnia is absolutely the lesser of two evils here. It just buys you time for the steroids and bronchodilators to actually work on the airway inflammation.
Which leads to what I think is the most intense clinical pearl in this entire framework. If you have an asthmatic or COPD patient who crashes after being intubated, like the vent alarms are screaming high pressure, their blood pressure plummets, the immediate intervention is to physically disconnect them from the ventilator.
You literally unplug them from life support.
Just take the tube off the machine to save their life.
Yes. By disconnecting the vent circuit, you remove all external positive pressure. You give that trapped, stacked air a path of least resistance to escape.
Oh, wow.
If it's auto-PEEP causing the crash, you will literally hear a prolonged, audible whoosh of exhaled air coming straight from the endotracheal tube.
That must be wild to see.
It is. And as the lungs deflate, the pressure on the vena cava releases. Venous return is restored. And you will watch their blood pressure rebound right in front of your eyes on the monitor.
That is incredible.
It is a profound demonstration of applied physiology.
Absolute physiological magic. Disconnect the machine to fix the machine.
Exactly.
Now, the framework also has a strict warning regarding oxygen administration specifically for chronic COPD patients. We are taught to be, you know, judicious with supplemental O2 because of the risk of wiping out their hypoxic drive.
This is a really important concept.
Can we unpack the mechanism there?
Yes.
Why does giving them oxygen cause them to stop breathing?
Okay, so in a healthy person, the primary drive to breathe is driven by central chemoreceptors in the brain sensing rising levels of CO2.
Right.
But in severe chronic COPD, the patient lives with a constantly elevated PCO2. Over time, those central receptors become desensitized to it. The body essentially resets its baseline.
It just accepts the high CO2 as the new normal.
Exactly. It gives up on trying to fix it. So the brain shifts its primary trigger for ventilation to the peripheral chemoreceptors, which monitor oxygen levels instead.
Oh, I see.
So they now breathe primarily because they are slightly hypoxic.
Their drive is low oxygen, not high CO2.
Right. If you walk in and blast them with high-flow oxygen, those peripheral receptors sense normal O2 saturation and send a signal to the brain saying, hey, we're good down here. You can slow down.
We have plenty of oxygen. No need to breathe so fast.
Exactly. Their respiratory rate drops, and because they aren't blowing off any gas, that already high CO2 climbs to toxic narcotic levels.
Wow.
They develop CO2 narcosis, become lethargic, and eventually they can stop breathing altogether.
That is wild.
That's why you aim for a targeted oxygen saturation, usually around 88 to 92% for a known COPD patient. You want to relieve life-threatening hypoxia without entirely suppressing their natural drive to ventilate.
It is an incredibly delicate tightrope walk. All right, to round out our impacts mnemonic, we land on the final letter T, tamponade and trauma.
The big T's.
We've touched on how increased thoracic pressure from a pneumothorax or breath stacking compresses the heart. Cardiac tamponade is that exact same hemodynamic disaster, but the compression is coming from fluid filling the pericardial sac itself.
And the mechanism here is driven by the anatomy of the pericardium. It's a very stiff, fibrous sac. It doesn't stretch easily at all.
It's rigid.
Right. If fluid, which is usually blood in a trauma setting, accumulates rapidly inside that sac, the pressure quickly exceeds the filling pressure of the right ventricle.
Because the right side of the heart operates at much lower pressures than the left.
Precisely. Diastolic filling is mechanically restricted. The heart simply cannot expand to receive venous return. And again, no preload means no cardiac output.
The pump is empty again.
Right. This is why you see Beck's triad. You get muffled heart sounds because of the flu barrier.
Like listening through water.
Exactly. You get distended neck veins because the blood is backing up from the right atrium. And you get profound hypotension.
And just like attention pneumothorax, you don't need a formal echocardiogram to diagnose a crashing tamponade patient.
No time for that.
Right. You need your clinical exam, and you need a needle for a pericardiocentesis to drain that fluid and let the ventricle expand.
Exactly. Relieve the pressure immediately.
And similarly, major chest trauma like a flail chest or massive pulmonary contusions that just destroys the structural integrity required to generate negative intrathoracic pressure in the first place. You can't pull air into a rigid container if the container is shattered.
Which perfectly brings us full circle back to the mechanics of the bellows.
It really does, the broken bellows. So if you're an intern standing at that bedside taking this all in, you don't just stare at the flashing monitors.
Right, you have a plan.
You actively visualize those four mechanisms. Is this a broken bellows hypoventilation, a wet sponge diffusion problem? a VQ roadblock, or an anatomical shunt.
Get the mechanism first.
Right. And while you lock down that physiology, you rapidly run the impact T checklist, impacted foreign body, MI, pneumonia, PE, pneumothorax, asthma, anaphylaxis, CHF, COPD, tamponade, and trauma.
You systematically rule out the killers. It turns a chaotic room into a manageable algorithm.
It really does. And remember, this is only part one. In our next deep dive, we'll finish Dr. Ribeiro's framework, getting into the infectious causes and the nuances of ARDS.
There's a lot more to cover.
For sure. But before we wrap, I want to leave you with one final thought based on the remarkably sobering point the framework makes about pulmonary embolisms.
Ah, yes. The diagnostic hiding game.
Exactly. We spent all this time today discussing S1Q3T3 patterns and Hampton's humps. But the reality, the framework notes that most EKGs for a PE are actually completely normal, except for sinus tachycardia.
Just a fast heart rate.
Right. And the chest x-ray, also usually completely normal. The most lethal rapid killer on the floor, a massive saddle embolus, often hides behind the most unremarkable, reassuring test results imaginable.
It's a terrifying reality of emergency medicine. The machines will lie to you.
They will. So I want you to reflect on that the next time you are evaluating a dysmagic patient. How much of practicing excellent medicine, especially when a life is actively on the line, is having the courage to trust your clinical gestalt, your physical exam, and your understanding of the physiology over the false comfort of a normal machine readout?